A special legislative session meets today to allocate recovery funding after Hurricane Michael. For farmer Rick Dollison and his community in Poland, Georgia, losses go far beyond dollars.
You have those seconds of pauses there where people just looking out into the sky and just, you know, we don't know what we're going to do.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up on Second Thought gets an update from the lives and communities turned upside down. Also today, the Catholic Archdiocese of Atlanta says it released the names of clergy credibly accused of sexual abuse in the interest of transparency. With 15 names spanning more than 60 years, some survivors are skeptical. We'll talk with one from Savannah who focuses on hope.
There's a lot of people that are suffering bad right now. So why would I not do everything I can to try to help them when I know where I've been and I know how you can come out of it?
All that coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The death toll remains at 44 people in California's devastating wildfires. Two people were killed in a blaze in Southern California. The fire in Northern California in Butte County has left at least 42 people dead. Melissa Schuster is a city council member in the town of Paradise destroyed by the wildfire. She says there are coroner teams searching every burned car and every burned home for more victims.
There are 6,400 homes that were burned. That's a lot of homes to have to go through to ensure that there are no human remains there.
More than 200 people remain missing in Butte County, and authorities expect the death toll will rise. The U.S. Senate race in Arizona has been called for Democrat Kyrsten Sinema. She defeated Republican Martha McSally in a very close contest. Ballots are being recounted for the U.S. Senate race in Florida, as well as the Florida governor's race. The governor's race in Georgia has not been called, and neither has a U.S. congressional race in Georgia. That race is one of more than a dozen outstanding U.S. congressional races across the country. President Trump's choice of Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general is drawing opposition from the state of Maryland. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The challenge involves the Affordable Care Act and its provisions protecting equal insurance rates for people with previous medical conditions. The Trump administration takes the position that the guarantee for people with previous medical conditions is illegal, that it was essentially struck from the law when Congress repealed the health insurance mandate provision. Maryland disagrees and argues that the acting attorney general has been illegally appointed, meaning that the man who's now overseeing all the department's litigation is illegally there and has no authority. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The family of an African-American security guard shot and killed by a white police officer while on duty at a nightclub in Chicago is filing a federal lawsuit. From member station WBEZ, Miles Bryan has more.
Jamel Roberson was armed and working security for the club. Witnesses say Roberson was subduing someone involved in the shooting when a white police officer from a nearby suburb called Midlothian shot and killed him. They say bystanders told police Roberson was working security. Greg Kulis is the Roberson family attorney.
Here was security trying to do their job, and law enforcement kills them.
The Midlothian Police Department did not respond to requests for comment. For NPR News, I'm Miles Bryan in Chicago.
Online retailer Amazon has chosen two cities to place its second headquarters, NPR has learned. They're in New York City and a suburb of Washington, D.C. Amazon is among NPR's financial supporters. An official announcement about the new locations for Amazon is expected soon. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Opening statements in the federal drug trial of Mexican citizen Joaquin Guzman are scheduled for today in New York. The man, also known as El Chapo, is accused of running a drug empire, ordering numerous murders, and laundering billions of dollars in drug money. He denies the charges. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency says Japan must take urgent action to remove contaminated water from the ruins of the Fukushima nuclear power plant. Carrie Skyring reports from Vienna.
Destroyed by a violent earthquake and tsunami 7 years ago, Fukushima remains a nuclear cleanup site. Now, after a week of inspections, the International Atomic Energy Agency is telling TEPCO, the plant's owners, to deal with up to 1 million tons of water contaminated by radioactive particles. Until recently, TEPCO was claiming the water had been removed. Japan's nuclear regulator says releasing the water into the ocean is the preferred method of disposal, but local fishermen oppose this. The IAEA says the water's removal is critical to the decommissioning of Fukushima. For NPR News, I'm Kerry Skyring in Vienna.
Stock markets in Asia were mixed today. Japan's Nikkei lost more than 2%, while markets in China rose. They followed a very down day on Wall Street Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 2%. The Nasdaq dropped more than 2.75%, led by a drop in technology stocks. Apple was one of the big losers, down more than 4%. Investors are also concerned about global economic growth. Wall Street opens in about half an hour. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include S&P Global Market Intelligence, committed to delivering essential data and insights to business and financial professionals. S&P Global Market Intelligence, know what matters, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over the past two decades, thousands of Catholic clergy worldwide have been accused as pedophiles. Last week, the Diocese of Atlanta and Savannah released the names of priests and seminarians under their respective authorities who've been credibly accused of sexually abusing minors dating back to the 1960s. In most states, the statute of limitations on these cases has meant many accused priests have not faced criminal charges. But last month, a legal loophole led to former Savannah Diocese priest Waylon Brown pleading guilty to 9 charges of criminal sexual conduct for abusing 2 boys in the 1970s and 80s. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Now, warning to listeners with children present and to others that we are going to be talking about that case with Chris Templeton. He's one of the 2 boys, so please do keep that in mind. As we welcome Chris from GPB in Savannah, Chris Templeton, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
And Mirtha Donnestorg is with us. She's a researcher for CNN's The Row and reported this story out of Savannah. Mirtha, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, I'm going to start with you because the story is so devastating. How old were you when you first met Waylon Brown?
I was 13 in 1987 is when I met Waylon Brown, in August of 1987. I was getting ready to start my 8th grade year.
So are you comfortable telling us about how this abuse began for you?
Yes, ma'am. It's taken a lot of therapy and a lot of help from God for me to become comfortable, but our whole mission today for me is to spread out the message of hope for other victims who we know are still out there, to let them know that they're not alone, and they don't have to stay in that lonely, depressive state, that we are here and God's here, and that we're willing to help and do anything we can. I grew up in a neighborhood right across the street from St. James School, where I went to school, and probably had about 400 houses, I guess, in the neighborhood, and it was a bunch of kids. And back when I was in school, we didn't start school till after Labor Day, after September, first week in September. So it was in August, and we used to ride our bicycles over to the school across the street. And play in the field, play baseball, basketball, football, whatever out in the field. And Waylon Brown had just been released from the treatment facility where they send the pedophile priest in Maryland. And he was just put back in St. James. And he used to come out there and watch us play ball. He got there and he was, I guess, put back in St. James in August of 1987. And a group of us were over there playing, and he started coming over there and throwing the football with us, and visiting with us and hanging out with us. That's how it all started.
Yeah. And you were just in eighth grade when you were abused, as you're estimating, 50 times in the span of 9 months. So yeah. Young. Were you able to tell anybody what was happening at that time?
No. From the first time that he raped me, I've learned this now and figured this out through a lot of therapy, but I blocked it out completely. Mm-hmm. I blocked it out and went straight into what I like to call a survival mode. Pretty much a loose cannon for the next 30 years, trying to survive and make it through life without thinking about what was going on. You know, from the first time it happened, I can realize that I had no control over it after that. You know, it just happened whenever he wanted to and however he wanted to after that first time. But I completely blocked it out and did not even remember it. I'd struggled with depression and stuff most of my life and just didn't know why. But I had blocked it out and didn't remember it till November of 2014. When I was in a suicidal state and went to a mental hospital, and that's how I remembered everything.
You started going to therapy, you surfaced these memories, and I just want to thank you again for your courage in telling us about this. And Mirtha, you know Chris was not Waylon Brown's first victim. Also, Alan Ranta was one of the boys named. Can you tell us about his case?
Yeah, so Alan was 9 years old. His abuse started in 1978, the year after Waylon Brown was ordained a priest in the Diocese of Savannah. So Alan Ranta was 9 years old. He was a fifth grader at St. James, the same school where 9 years later Waylon Brown would meet Chris. And he formed a relationship, a friendship with this little nine-year-old boy. And he formed a trust between the two of them. And eventually he drove him over the Talmadge Bridge, took him to the Savannah National Wildlife Refuge in South Carolina, and he raped him there. Over the next few years, he would abuse him in multiple places in South Carolina as well as in Savannah, at the St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Hardeeville, South Carolina, also at an old train depot and this wildlife refuge. And like Chris, Alan also had this suppression of memories. It wasn't until he was in his mid-30s that he, as he called it, he had this memory recall where everything came back to him. And so it's a pattern of not only abuse, but of trauma that even though it happened 9 years apart, you can see in both Alan and in Chris.
Yeah, the confusion or the way that the memory is stored in the brain is not so predictable. And the, you know, that's a twisted thing that you mentioned. He established trust and eventually really broke that trust in such a horrific way. And Chris, you knew Alan Ranta as a kid, right? Did you ever get in touch? And when did you realize you were both victims of Waylon's pattern of abuse?
Well, Alan was a good bit older than me. I had two older brothers, and he was between my two older brothers. I remember Alan in the neighborhood. Alan was, like I said, older, but Alan was a real good athlete. So, you know, the younger guys, we looked up at him, to him. He was a real good swimmer, big national swimmer. And, you know, I knew his family. My parents knew his family real well. But I had not seen Alan. St. James only goes through eighth grade. And then after eighth grade, the parochial school, you go to the high school. So when I was in the eighth grade, Alan, my brothers, all of them were gone. And Alan and I got back in touch after my civil case ended. And we were working on the criminal case. There was an organization called SNAP that did had a meeting here in Savannah. And there was a little protest we did out in front of the Diocese of Savannah on Victory Drive. And Alan came in town for that. And I guess that was about 2 years ago. And that's when I was able to reconnect with Alan. And, you know, we've kept in touch since then, worked hard. You know, we just really, what we were looking for was that criminal guilty plea. And, you know, we both feel like that's what's going to help others come forward. You know, I don't use the word to give them courage to come forward, because any victim is full of courage, for them to have lived through that and survived through that, they're full of courage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just giving them the willingness to come forward, and make them realize, you know, it's a lonely, scary place to be. Before you come forward. And it's not the easiest thing to talk about, and it's not the easiest thing to admit. And if you don't have the strong family support like I've had, it's hard, you know? And, you know, so Alan and I, so we've been able to keep in touch, and we really talked a lot during this last year, you know, more. I don't know how much, but we talked the most in the last year after Waylon Brown was indicted, and we were leading up to the criminal case.
So that forming community, I think, is such an important part of the story, and the isolation that so many kids and survivors feel in general. Now, Mirtha, this is the interesting part here, that this happened in after suing the Diocese of Savannah, in this civil case and then going for the criminal case. The legal loophole, when Chris and Allen came forward, the statute of limitations in Georgia had passed. So how did prosecutors manage to send Brown to jail?
So, yeah, so District Attorney Meg Heap in Chatham County, where Savannah is, she first got these allegations from Chris and Allen. And so she started looking into them, realized that she wouldn't be able to prosecute them because in the 70s and 80s, the statute of limitations on child sex abuse that had already passed. So she started reaching out for help from other law enforcement agencies. She reached out to the federal U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Georgia, and he was looking into it, but he couldn't bring charges, again, statute of limitations. And so once she learned that the Father Brown had taken them across the Savannah River into Jasper County, she reached out to Solicitor Duffy Stone, not knowing if he would be able to bring charges, but just she needed to see if something could happen. And Solicitor Stone did some research into the laws and into the crimes and realized that he would be able to bring charges because there was no statute of limitations on child sex abuse.
And so now he's admitted, Waylon Brown admitted, or pleaded guilty, let's say. Where is Waylon Brown now?
So he is no longer a father. He was removed from the priesthood in 2004. He is 76, serving 20 years at the Kirkland Prison in Columbia, South Carolina.
Now, Chris mentioned that it was when Father Brown had come back from, I'm not sure if he was a father at that point, but when he came back from a rehabilitation stint for what he had done to Allen. So is that evidence that church leaders knew that he was a predator?
Yeah, so he was still a father. It wouldn't be until like almost 20 years later that he was removed from the priesthood. But he was sent to rehab, according to Solicitor Stone. He was sent to rehab officially for alcohol issues, but the church had received some allegations, abuse allegations, not related to Allen Ranta, but to different children. And so they sent him to the St. Luke Institute, which might sound familiar because the Boston Globe, in their original reporting, that was the place where priests were also sent.
The spotlight team.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So this is... Chris, we're gonna come up against a break in just a minute, but this is a big question. So many would-be criminal charges are stopped in their tracks by the statutes of limitation. So how long did it take to get Waylon Brown's guilty plea?
Well, it took a huge effort from, like she said, Meg Heap, you know, Jim Durham, the U.S. attorney, and Duffy Stone. I can't say enough about them, along with the help of Judge Mary Catherine Moss in Savannah, Georgia. They just were tremendous. They were awesome. I guess it took about 2 years. It took about a year to get him indicted, and then it took a year for the trial to come. So about 2 years. But, you know, it was from when we met with Meg Heap. Now, it took us another year, me and my family and I and my civil attorney. We did a lot of work, you know, from probably 2015 to 16, a good year ourselves trying to gather all the evidence to take to Meg Heap.
Right.
So a good 3 years, I would say.
What did it mean for you to hear Waylon Brown plead guilty for what he did to you and Allen?
I can't explain the emotion that came over me when I heard it. You know, it was just amazing. It just felt like slow motion when the judge said, you know, he asked for our permission, the judge did before the case, if he could use our names in the charges. And when he said, charge that you took Christopher Templeton over the state lines to St. Anthony's Mission Church and raped him behind the altar and in the altar boy room. And the judge said to Waylon Brown, now, how do you plead to that charge? And he said, guilty, Your Honor, guilty. Without a stop, without a pause. And the emotion and the tears just overwhelmed me because, you know, that was a victory for my 13-year-old self, who I think of often and feel like died at that time, that little child soul.
So. I am so moved by your story. I'm sure listeners are too, but we're going to put it on pause for just a minute while we take a break and come back with Chris Templeton, one of those who was vindicated, let's say, when Waylon Brown pleaded guilty to abusing children as a Catholic priest. Mirtha Donnestorig is a researcher for CNN's The Row, and she reported this story. We'll be back in just a minute. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our conversation with Chris Templeton and Mirtha Donnestorig. Catholic priests pleaded guilty to sexually abusing children in Savannah last month, and Chris is one of those. Mirtha Donnestorig reported on Chris's story for CNN. So what about, Mirtha, the Savannah Diocese? Did they ever comment on Brown's conviction or take responsibility?
Yes. So they said that they agree that justice was served and they hoped that it would bring a measure of peace. But beyond that, they didn't respond to Brown having been sent to rehab before. They didn't respond to any of the other allegations.
Now, Chris, the Atlanta Archdiocese and Savannah just released a list of priests and other seminarians, quote, credibly accused of sexual abuse. This is something that many of those survivors that I've read about, seen it on Twitter, et cetera, have said, you know, 15 priests for dating back to the 1960s doesn't sound like the spirit of transparency. I wonder what your thoughts are.
No, not at all. I mean, they were forced to do what they did. You know, they did it even after Atlantis. I'm talking of Savannah's right now. But, you know, until they released the names of the bishops, the priests, you know, Father Keneally, Father McCarthy, the ones, Bishop Lessard, Bishop Boland, who were involved in covering up and protecting this pedophile for 20 and 30 years, and the attorney for the diocese, Joe Brennan, at the time. Until they list them, because I hold them, me being a victim myself, being a survivor, we hold the people that hid them, protected them, and covered it up just as responsible for us being raped as the priest that raped us. And until those people are exposed, until those people are removed from ministry, there is no moving forward. I mean, until you get rid of the poison, nothing's going to prosper. You know, so it didn't do anything for me. It didn't make me happy at all. I mean, you know, maybe we headbutted them enough, or maybe we've tugged on their pants leg enough, or maybe we've bothered them enough or been a big enough pest that they said, oh, we'll just go ahead and throw these 15 names out there. I mean, who got the names? The bishop released the names? I mean, did any authorities go through the paperwork with them to find out? I mean, have they released all their records? No. All they released was names of people who they wanted to list.
Well, Chris, we really have just 1 minute left, and I know that you're doing. No, please, I'm so, as you said, you are telling your story to embolden other people to not feel so alone and maybe tell their own. If you could just quickly, what's your message to other survivors out there who maybe haven't reckoned with this?
Yeah, get some help. Please call. My number is out there public. Call me anytime, day or night. Contact a therapist. Please get help. Call a lawyer. Do not do this alone, because the guilt and the shame will kill you. And I wanted to thank you guys, because if it wasn't for media and people like you that are willing to put us on the air and help us spread the message to other victims, it wouldn't get out. And thank you so much. Y'all mean so much. Mirtha, love you. Thank you so much.
Chris Templeton, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Mirtha Donnestorig, researcher for CNN's The Row, reported the story out of Savannah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.